Thanks for spending your Wednesday with us on The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke, and Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas is with us this hour. Hi, C.R.
Hello.
And later this hour, you and I are going to talk about whether protesters should be allowed to wear masks. There's a bill in Olympia that's deciding whether or not that should be criminalized or not. But first, let's talk about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Earlier this month, we learned that there was a tunnel that partially collapsed. There may be radioactive waste still leaking because of that collapse. But that's really only part of the problem. News out of the other Washington, the new budget proposal, cuts $119 million in funding from Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And it's a significant cut. Hanford cleanup costs about $2 billion a year. And Washington's congressional delegation isn't having it. Senator Patty Murray said, "I will fight back with every tool that I have to make sure the federal government holds up its end of the bargain." So, CR, what bargain are we talking about here? What bargain is Senator Patty Murray referring to?
Well, the bargain is that Washington State has been in a legal battle with the federal government for probably two decades now about cleanup at Hanford. This, of course, is a result of plutonium and all the other activities related to World War II and nuclear bombs. And this is the residue of that. And the government has and is on the hook for cleaning it up, but their feet have been held to the fire, if you will, by our local delegation, both our congressional delegation, but also state leaders like Governor Inslee and others. So that's the deal she's talking about. I mean, they will take the and have taken the federal government to court on a number of occasions to uphold the EPA's commitment to clean up what is the largest Superfund site in the country.
So we've taken the federal government to court to get more money to clean up the Superfund site. Have we been successful? Have we won those court battles?
We have. And we now get $2 billion a year, $2 billion plus, to help clean this up. So it's never enough and not as much as our delegation wants, but it's something. I was over at Hanford. I actually took a tour when the governor, this governor, Inslee, made his first trip to Hanford after being elected. And we went and saw the area where some leaking tanks are. We also saw this big glassification plant that is being built. That is the solution at Hanford. They're going to take all this sludge and waste that is now being stored in tanks and glassify it so that it can be in a stable condition for several hundred years. Because right now, obviously, the liquid sludge is leaking. So it's a massive operation. And yes, the federal government is funding this. I mean, that glassification plant will cost $17 billion, if you can believe it.
You pointed out that we've been mostly successful at winning court battles against the federal government to get more money for cleanup. But you also said that overall, Hanford is kind of a losing battle. Fighting for cleanup money is a losing battle. Why is that?
Well, because the problem is so enormous. And $2 billion a year doesn't do it. Like I said, this plant's going to cost $17 billion. It is so sophisticated and so technically difficult to deal with radioactive waste that this is not going to be up and running in full capacity until 2036. I mean, we will have light rail throughout the region, right, before that. So this glassification process is very, very difficult and time-consuming. Basically, they're building a facility that no one will ever enter. They will be putting the sludge in one end and it'll be coming out glass at the other, and the whole inside will forever be contaminated. And then they'll take this glass and be able to store it in a much better state for hundreds of years. But that is expensive and takes so long. So there's never enough money. And partly why it will take so long is because the budget isn't big enough. The Hanford story is so fascinating because we won World War II 70 years ago, and it will probably take another 70 years before that is cleaned up, the residue of that from Hanford. It will be up in operation by 2036, I believe, but it's going to take 20, 30 more years even to complete that process. It is a massive, massive undertaking.
CR, I feel like we have a little bit of a privileged remove from Hanford, being west of the Cascades, being here in Seattle. I mean, most media only really talks about Hanford when there's some sort of catastrophe there, when there's a significant waste leak, when we hear about budget cuts, something like this. But what do you think we here in Seattle need to understand about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation?
Well, we need to understand that it is a huge problem that could get worse before it gets better. Because when this radioactive material sludge leaks, when it penetrates one of these tanks, it gets closer and closer and closer to groundwater. It gets closer and closer to the Columbia River. And the worst thing, I mean, can you imagine something worse than this radioactive waste getting in the Columbia and then contaminating, you know, the best river probably in North America? So it's huge. It's why our congressional delegation isn't even split DNR on this, right? They are united, both the Democrats and the Republicans, that this situation needs to be taken care of. It needs to be taken care of fast, because the danger is further contamination to our pristine areas in Eastern Washington.
I'm going to put you in the position of, crystal ball soothsayer here. You talked about how we've had to take the federal government to court before. The congressional delegation from Washington is united on this. And, you know, we've seen a couple of letters from the congressional delegation asking the Department of Energy, asking the Trump administration not to cut funding to Hanford during this budget round. But do you think that anyone will listen to our congressional delegation, or are we looking at more court battles potentially?
Well, it's a test of Patty Murray's clout under a Republican president. She had quite a bit of clout when Obama was in town, even when they were in the minority in the Senate, the Democrats. But now she's in a double minority, right? Minority in the Senate, and also the Democrats don't control the White House. We don't yet know how Patty Murray, who is our senior senator, the senior member of our delegation, will fare in that kind of circumstance. I don't know how much headway they'll get on this. It's an over $2 billion a year budget, and we're talking about a cut of $120 million. So it's not as though this is being axed by 50% or something, but every dollar counts. And but listen, every program, it looks like, is going to have to take a hit under the Trump budget. I mean, if you keep Social Security and Medicare, which he's promised to do, if you increase military spending significantly, almost everything else is going to take a cut.
Thank you so much, CR. We'll keep talking about what's happening at Hanford and what the Trump budget might mean for the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk about how Jimi Hendrix's childhood home helped save a trailer park. We'll also talk a little bit about density in King and Pierce counties. We're also going to hear about how we should think about going to big events in the wake of the attack at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester earlier this week. This is The Record. Ariana Grande has canceled shows in London and put her tour on hold following Monday's bombing at a concert in Manchester, England, that killed 22 people and injured dozens more. Yesterday, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May put the country on high alert, deploying the military to help guard against another attack, while police investigate whether more people were involved in Monday's bombing. And while all of this happened an ocean away, the sight of an attack on a teen pop concert might have you thinking about what you would do, how you would respond, and whether you should do anything differently when you go to big events. We found a Seattleite who has thought a lot about this. Officer Simon Phillips is the community engagement officer with the University of Washington Police Department. He worked in anti-terrorism with the British military and teaches people how to prepare themselves for a possible attack. He says when people are faced with a traumatic, immediate event, there's a rush of physiological things that can happen to the human body.
And what that does, amongst other things, is that it brings on some what I call natural response elements. So we've often heard about flight, fight, or freeze, and that's often what will happen. Now, in the event of something as traumatic and impactful as this, you can imagine that probably for most people, the flee response is going to take over, followed right after by the freeze instinct. Again, it depends on the type of situation, but for these very traumatic events, such as a large-scale bombing, then you would anticipate the flee response would be the greatest.
What do you do to think through a response like that, to prepare for possibly being in a circumstance like that?
So I think there are ways that you can, in fact, pre-plan mentally. One of the things that is very popular in law enforcement and in the military is called what-ifing a situation. And what you basically do is say to yourself, well, what would I do if this happened? And what a lot of people find useful is to think it through. And often we have this this narrative in our head, and it's almost like we're watching a video that we're playing inside our own head of how we would expect that outcome to develop. Just like ultra athletes, people who are really at the top of their game, will imagine themselves winning. Well, we can imagine ourselves coming through a difficult situation positively, and that can have very positive effects. So if we visualize ourselves successfully getting ourselves and our kids out of a venue during an event because something negative has happened, there's a good chance that we're going to do that. And if we run it through our head a couple of times, regardless of where the venue is, then when we are prompted by that sudden shocking act, there's a much better chance that we'll actually follow through with that because we've seen it in our minds. We've played it through in our minds before. So that kind of playing the video, running like a video through your head a couple of times, and it can be very non-specific, but that can be a call to action should that event ever take place.
I'm talking with Officer Simon Phillips. He's the Community Engagement Officer for the University of Washington Police Force. And listeners have probably picked this up, but you have a British accent.
I do. 20 years in the United States, and I don't think I'm ever going to lose it.
That's fair. But you grew up in the south of London, and you served in the British military. So when you heard about this news, what did you think?
It broke my heart. I spent nearly 14 years in the British military, and ironically, a lot of my time as an army officer there was spent in counter-terror research as an advisor and a trainer, and also in what we refer to commonly as the bomb squad. So when I hear something like this, it definitely brings it home. Manchester, sadly, in its history, has been the site of other terrorist attacks in the past, too. So my heart goes out to the people of Manchester and also to my colleagues in law enforcement and in the military who would be responding to those kind of incidents. Plus, I'm the father of two young daughters who, again, it's not hard to project how easily that could potentially be your kids. But right now, I'm just feeling a lot of weight for the families and the friends of those that have lost loved ones and those that were gravely wounded. And, my thoughts and prayers are with them and will continue with them.
I think you're right when you say it's not hard to project with something like this. I heard from a couple of parent friends between last night and this morning who said, I won't ever allow my child to go to a big sporting event. I won't allow my child to go to a large concert after news like this. Summer in Seattle, it feels like there are festivals just everywhere where there's folk life this weekend here. East of the Cascades, there's Sasquatch. What would you like us to be thinking about as we're planning on perhaps making community with people at these festivals or asking ourselves whether we feel safe doing so?
Right. Well, I think one of the greatest exhibitions of our community and of our togetherness is when we continue to go to these large-scale events and we reach out to other people. And it's a collaborative effort. I mean, it really is. We're all part of this, right? We're all part of the same effort to try and build that better community. And I think we do that by continuing to support these wonderful events, by being smart, by being self-aware and having common sense. And like I say, we don't need to be hyper-vigilant, but we just, I would suggest, need to be maybe a little more aware than sometimes we are and maybe get a little less sidetracked by the distractions that are in our 21st century life and look after each other. That's the other part of it. That's one of the amazing things that we see when these events take place. Regardless of where it is around the world, the communities pull together. There are incredible stories of acts of great courage and bravery and sacrifice, as well as great kindness and of community. And that is what I think we can take from many of these things. So I would celebrate going out to these great Pacific Northwest events. I think that sends the strongest message to the people that would want to do us harm and do our way of life harm.
That's Officer Simon Phillips. He's the Community Engagement Officer for the University of Washington Police Department. And C.R. Douglas, he talked in there about scenario imagining, right? That he called it what-ifing, that idea of having a video playing in your head of a bad thing happening, of bad events occurring, to think through what you'd do if you found yourself in that situation. Is that something that you've done before? What do you think about that?
I have a little bit unconsciously. I was thinking about experience just a few weeks ago when he was talking, which was I was at a cabaret show in a pretty small venue. And I was kind of wondering what happened if we all needed to get out. And I was sort of more thinking of a fire, not a terrorist thing. I am pretty severely claustrophobic. So when I am in small spaces, I tend to think about that. And I noticed there was another door in this little cabaret space, but it was such a funky space, it didn't have the required exit sign. But at least I kind of mentally thought, okay, if I need to get out, there are a couple ways. I think that's a wise thing to think about. I probably don't do it enough. I do it in smaller spaces and not bigger ones. We're lucky, however, that we're not really a region that's experienced this terrorism. We've had, you know, a lot of successful events with very few problems. I mean, the one notable thing we have, I can remember, is that bomber that was threatening a foiled attempt to, you know, bomb the Space Needle right. celebration in the millennial 1999. But other than that, and we can tend to get complacent because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most recent thing I can remember was a plan to bomb Neighbor's Nightclub on New Year's Eve in recent memory.
That's true. I think that was a one-off and not necessarily right. ISIS-inspired.
No, it wasn't.
But yeah, we're pretty safe. I have aged out of a lot of these music festivals, but my nieces and nephews have aged into them, and they go to Sasquatch and Paradiso and even Coachella down in California. And I can say these places are getting, you know, they have gotten progressively more, you know, looking through your baggage, looking through your backpacks as you go in. And I think those are smart policies. And tricky is the nighttime events. That's what the Manchester event was. That was really the Orlando nightclub. Nighttime it's a time where trouble happens more. One little thing I'll say about this, I was in Disneyland last year with a friend and her kids, and we were there for a couple days, and we had gone through the day, and of course you're thoroughly checked going to Disneyland, your bags and all that kind of stuff. I went back at night and went back to the hotel, and I went back in at night. And then they put me through a metal detector, you know, full like an airport thing at night. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. This is probably what they do at night because the worry is higher for a nighttime event.
Yeah. Yeah. I know several people who went to the U2 concert here who also walked through metal detectors. It's what happens. And I do briefly just want to highlight that Officer Phillips also said, think about a successful outcome. Imagine these things. Think about a successful outcome. I feel like that's worth highlighting. It's very easy to go down a wormhole of fright. Yes. If you don't imagine a successful outcome for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And you won't enjoy the experience.
This is The Record on KUOW. As we think about big events here in Seattle, let's talk about the May Day marches for a little while. Lots of protesters wore masks during those protests. It's actually a fairly common sight, and it's not illegal. But State Senator Jim Honeyford of Eastern Yakima County thinks sometimes it should be. He's got a bill in the state legislature aimed at, quote, organized groups whose members wear masks while committing criminal acts. And State Senator Honeyford is on the line with us now. Hi, Senator. I know that you're hoping this bill will prevent criminal activity. How do you know that that's an issue among protesters who wear masks?
Well, I would call them rioters that wear masks. And you look at why do they wear a mask? So they can conceal their identity and get away with their violent acts.
Well, Senator, I feel like I need to point out that the legislature is currently in a second special session. We talked about this yesterday on The Record. There are two priorities for the special session: to come up with a budget, to figure out how to fund education. So why do you think this bill needs to be a priority right now as well? Why not wait until next year's session?
Well, it will wait. I believe it will wait till next year's session. Any bill that's been introduced in the first session or in the special sessions is carried forward to next year, and so I anticipate this would get a hearing and some action in January of next year.
What are you hoping to achieve by having the conversation about it now, though, and bringing attention to this now?
Well, I just introduced it as timely when it was fresh in people's minds, the violence that the rioters did in Olympia and apparently down in Portland. I think that's fresh in everybody's mind, and I believe that we really need to do something about it.
Senator Honeyford, this is C.R. Douglas with Q13 News. Just a question here. The language, the most recent language I saw in this bill, talks about making it illegal for someone to stand on a sidewalk, road, or a public ground with their face covered. You have some exceptions if it's for religious reason or if they're going to a, you know, Halloween masquerade ball or something like that. But it's still, critics will say it's a bit broad, that you can't even stand on a sidewalk with a mask. Is that a correct reading?
I believe so. And the legislative process is such that we have hearings on bills and we get input from all sides, and that's considered, and bills change before they get to their final form. And so that's what I anticipate happening.
Because I noticed some of the other states have done this, so you're certainly not the only one worried about this and concerned about this, but North Dakota, for instance, has a more narrower bill, law actually now, where you can't wear a mask if you're intending by that mask to evade prosecution or arrest. So that seems to strike at what your point is. You're worried about people that are using masks illegally, and yet it still feels like it's written pretty broad. Would you agree to a more narrower definition, which may be legally more defendable?
How do you prove intent?
Well, that's a good question, but how do you prove not intent? I mean, aren't you opening yourself up to a lot of problems and legal challenges if you can't even wear a hood or a mask on a sidewalk if you're just sitting there, you know, doing? Isn't that your First Amendment right? I guess maybe I'll put it that way.
Well, I don't believe the First Amendment right is a blanket right. You look at freedom of speech, and that's where they're basing this on. You can't yell fire in a theater. That's illegal. And so there are some perimeters about these freedoms, and I believe this should be one of them.
So
I'm looking at rioters, people that are out there breaking the law, that want to break the law, using the mask to conceal their identity.
And that, I think, people will be sympathetic to. I guess my question is, can you write it more narrowly so that you are... It's clear that's what you're worried about. I mean, I think you aren't worried about the guy who happens to, for whatever reason, wear a mask on the sidewalk just because he wants to. I mean, you don't seem to be concerned about that, but your law seems to capture that person under this net of arrest and prosecution.
Well, that's what I said. The hearing process will bring out the strengths and weaknesses of the proposed legislation, and changes will be made. And I point to the other states that have these similar laws. There are 11 states, District of Columbia, and I understand one reporter tells me there's 19 other states considering it. They have similar laws on the books, and apparently either they have not been challenged or they have been challenged and found that they're all right.
Senator Honeyford, how much support do you expect to get from your colleagues on this bill?
Oh, I expect it'll be pretty well divided. There are those that firmly believe that rioters should not hide their identity, and there's others that think it's a constitutional right to go out and riot and cover your face with a mask. So it'll be interesting.
Well, State Senator Jim Honeyford, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
So, C.R. Douglas, you asked him about anonymity and whether protesters have a right to anonymity. Do they? You've done a little bit of an analysis of what these laws look like in other places in the country.
Yeah, and as I said, there are more than you think. I mean, even California, New York, some blue states have these kinds of laws. But a lot of them are written more narrowly. It's clear you have a right to dress up, even provocatively, and even hide your identity. The question is what circumstance. So, for instance, if I want to go to the Fremont Solstice Parade in March and I can be, you know, in a sun costume, no one's going to arrest me. In fact, I would win the battle if someone did. If I want to go to a Seahawks game, I can probably paint my face up, in effect mask myself and put on a crazy Seahawk wig, and that's fine. So context matters here. But it is a great sort of First Amendment question. Do you have a right to be anonymous? Do you have a First Amendment right to be anonymous? And in some circumstances, you do. This will, of course, get tested. He is right that there have been some cases that have upheld these and some that have shot them down. But I suspect it's going to be a hard sell no matter what in Olympia. But unless it's more tailored, and even he admits he's really only worried about the lawless anarchist Mayday type.
The rioters, as he called them.
Yeah. And really that's all people care about. So to have a law that more directly tries to get at that is I think, you know, it's certainly legitimate. I mean, one problem with the Mayday protesters is that they do come in masks and they are committed to violence. And it's very hard to arrest and prosecute them, because if you don't catch them there, you're trying to catch them on security video and dash cam and cell phone. You know, that's what you typically do to catch a perpetrator. Who you didn't catch at, you know, after the fact catching, you can't identify these people because they're masked. It does hinder law enforcement in these criminal acts.
Well, I'd be curious to know what you think about this as well, listeners. You can email us at record@kuow.org. You can also leave us a message at 206-221-3663. Every day in our region, old buildings get demolished and new buildings go up in their place. The construction is so constant, big changes to our neighborhoods can start to feel inevitable. But sometimes big projects don't happen. That's what saved the trailer park across the street from Jimi Hendrix's grave in Renton, south of Seattle. For KUOW's Region of Boom team, Joshua McNichols has the story.
The body of musician Jimi Hendrix lies in Renton. Right across the street from the cemetery is the Highland Mobile Manor Park. It's a small trailer park that looks like it hasn't changed much since it was built in 1959. A few years ago, Jeremy Chirinos was just a kid riding his scooter around the trailer park. One day, a 900-square-foot house showed up on a flatbed truck. It was a small house, but it towered above the surrounding trailers. It was Jimi Hendrix's childhood home.
And I was like, who is this guy? Like, I had no idea who he was.
Jimi Hendrix lived in that two-bedroom house for a while in the 1950s when it was in Seattle's Central District. He learned to play guitar there. But Chirinos didn't know any of that back then.
Yeah, it was just weird. And I remember like riding my scooter around it too, and just, I don't know, you could say almost like disrespecting a legend's property, I don't know.
A developer named Peter Sykoff had bought Hendrix's house in order to save it. He sunk lots of money into it. I'll play just a few seconds from a conversation I had with him a few years ago, so you can get a sense of how he approaches real estate.
I see them not necessarily as real estate projects, really, as much as experiential art projects, experiential music projects, or asylums for people to be able to experience and express whatever it is that they may wish.
So not your typical developer, right? Anyway, he planned to restore Hendrix's childhood home. It would become the centerpiece of a music museum across from Hendrix's grave, with a recording studio and a music school for kids. Volunteers would run it. Oh, and it would wipe out the trailer park.
To me, I'm a Hendrix fan, so it didn't bother me as far as, well, everybody's got to move.
Jim Davis has managed the mobile home park for years. He lives a quiet life there, taking care of his terminally ill wife. But once, when he was 18 years old back in 1970, he saw Hendrix in concert.
Wow, I'll never forget it.
To Davis, the ambitious project planned for the trailer park where he lived seemed like the perfect celebration of Hendrix's life and personality.
If you really listen to him, whew, what a great human being. Really, really. Just love him.
So do you remember how it felt when the house showed up here?
Early in the morning, maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, dead silence. Nobody really other than the neighbor was out there. And we cranked some Jimi Hendrix. 5 in the morning. Yeah, a band of gypsies. Yeah, that's what we did in honor of it.
What kind of reaction did you get from your neighbors?
one complaint, and it was a guy that didn't live here. He would just stay in the night. I laughed at him. Told him to go back to bed. Gone again.
There were early signs that the project wasn't completely thought out.
They had to cut the roof off to get it underneath the power lines.
The house relied on a tarp for protection from the weather.
The tarp flew off on a windstorm. bad news, rain. Anyway, we saved it.
Davis and his wife became the house's protectors.
We really cared a lot about it, you know what I mean? It was like, really wanted it to happen. Don't you
shoot him down. But the developer ran into problems. 4 years passed with no major progress. Renton grew weary of the house with a fence around it and made him take it away.
And the deal with the Jimi Hendrix, you know, it was a lack of getting the right permit with the city.
He's still sad about what happened to the house.
Gotta let it be. Yeah. Just let it be.
I just came home one day and it was gone.
That's Trailer Park resident Hector Cano.
And then I'm like, what the heck happened to the house?
Today, there's just a couple concrete pads at the spot. The youngest kids in the trailer park use it to play soccer. Every year, thousands of people visit the grave across the street. But in the trailer park, most people don't think about Hendrix that much. Jim Davis keeps photos of the house on his wall, and he tells people about Hendrix if they ask. Trailer Park resident Jeremy Chirinos recognized Jimi Hendrix when he showed up in a video game he was playing.
I remember playing Rock Band, right? And then he would just come out there playing. So, I mean, not my, you know, cup of tea, but yeah, pretty sure he was good.
A few trailers down, Hector Cano has developed a mild appreciation for Hendrix's music. But he seems even more inspired by the impact Hendrix had, despite his modest beginnings.
Everybody comes from a humble place, you know. Not everybody's rich when they grow up or anything, you know.
Cano works at Arby's, but he has this dream of using technology to bring clean water to people in drought-stricken countries. He's not certain yet how he'll make that happen. But this summer, he expects to sit by Hendrix's grave across the street and do some thinking.
You never know, you can get inspiration by someone that's dead or something, you know?
There may not be a Jimi Hendrix museum in Renton, but there is this affordable place for people to live and dream.
You know, it ended up good. Regardless of the house not being here, look at all the people that get to live here, all the families. Woo, I think Jimmy would be happy.
So in the end, it wasn't that bad?
Nah. I think Jimmy'd be smiling.
The developer still owns the trailer park. When he took the house away, he chopped it up into pieces. He's holding onto the wood. Someday he hopes to turn it into guitars that he can sell. In Renton, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW's Region of Boom team has been reporting from Renton, Kent, and Auburn all this month. You can find more of their stories online at kuow.org. And this week, I learned more Americans are moving to the suburbs and at an accelerating pace. That's according to a story in the New York Times. But there's an exception, and it's Seattle. Between 2010 and 2016, Seattle saw increased density in our urban neighborhoods. In fact, we saw a higher increase in density than Chicago, New York, and Boston combined. Social media producer Bon Huberman, how have people been talking about density in Seattle on KUOW's Facebook page?
Hey, Jeannie. When I shared this story, it sparked a lot of feelings. Carrie writes, "It honestly sucks. I'm a fifth-generation Seattleite, and even with a pretty decent job and college education, I can no longer afford it here. I have to relocate if I want to own a piece of property, even a condo, and that's with two incomes. That's progress, I guess." Melanie writes, "What would Emmett Watson say? The only consolation is knowing that if you moved to Seattle in the last 15 years, you missed it." And side note, I feel like I should admit that I did move to Seattle in the last 15 years and I didn't know who Emmett Watson was. So I Googled it and I guess I learned that I'm part of the problem. Back to the listeners. David reminds us the alternative to density is sprawl, which would be at least as costly to those seeking housing with even worse regional traffic and truly horrific environmental consequences. The people assuming rapid densification is responsible for increasing cost of living almost certainly have the causality backwards. Hmm.
Thank you very much, Bond. So, CR, I know you know who Emmett Watson is, but is density a problem for us here in Seattle?
Well, you can be stuck in traffic because of density, and yet you're headed to more and interesting restaurants than you would have had. You can be stuck in traffic because of density, and you're headed to more and interesting sporting and entertainment events. You can be stuck in traffic, but you're heading to better and higher paying jobs. So there's an upside downside to it. And I don't think it's an accident that we top that list that you talked about, because it has been a deliberate policy of not just, you know, local leaders, but state leaders to channel growth into our major urban places like Seattle. We have one of the most aggressive growth management acts back in the 90s, which led to cities and counties creating and designated spots that was going to take future growth. So yes, we've developed in a lot of parts of Puget Sound, but it's not the kind of sprawl that we had in the decades before. We're not plowing down more foothills for big suburban developments at the same rate we have. What we're doing is we're putting a ton of people in these urban core areas, and overlay that on top of the light rail program. These corridors where light rail is being served are being densified. So that has been the plan. This is what the region wanted and asked for. The thing that's happening is that it's coming about faster than we expected. We have growth targets that are being achieved way earlier in all different parts of town in the region. And I think a big factor in that is our economy and Amazon.
Well, but there's also a political side to this, too, right? I mean, we have 21 candidates in the Seattle mayor's race right now, and density is a big issue. That's something they all have to talk about. So how does that show up in the mayor's race?
Well, it's being talked about more in terms of inequality, but certainly density is a part of it. You have Mayor McGinn doing this big rebrand. He was the guy that was for growth. He was upzoning a lot of neighborhoods, actually trying to upzone them more than the council let him during his 4 years. He is now the sort of lesser Seattle guy, if you will, and this goes to Emmett Watson. Emmett Watson was a longtime columnist for the Seattle Times and famously coined the phrase lesser Seattle. He was worried about, in the 70s, you know, too much growth, and created this group, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but ended up really kind of convicted about it, that we need to keep Seattle small and keep, at that point, it was a lot of Californians coming up, and we were losing something. And McGinn is channeling some Emmett Watson in this race, which is a change from what he's been. And others in the race are saying, hey, this is what we asked for. And in fact, we should be putting the pedal even harder on this. I mean, Justin Farrell, the state representative from Northeast Seattle, has said we need to do even more for density. So it is playing out in the mayor's race.
Well, I'm sure we will keep talking about density as we move forward with the mayor's race, as we move forward talking about what this region looks like. But coming up, we are going to talk about two brothers from Kent who decamped for LA. They're YouTube stars, but their childhood in Kent still informs what they do. This is The Record from KUOW.
Oh, I know what you're going to do. You're going to take that old, rich, white guy's brain and stick it into my younger, fit, exotic body, huh?
No, there's gonna be no body switching today. I think my customer over there would be a little bit upset about that.
Oh, wait, why not? What do you mean?
You know, it's just like, maybe it's not, you know.
Is it because I'm an Asian guy?
That's a parody of the movie Get Out by Andrew and David Fung, a.k.a. the Fung Brothers. And when you heard that, you might have thought, wait, I know those guys. And it's possible you do. They grew up in Kent, second-generation Chinese, but today they live in Los Angeles and they're rising YouTube stars. They've got more than 1 million followers. Their breakout hit 5 years ago was a celebration of the Asian food in L.A.'s San Gabriel Valley. It's called 626, which is the area code for the valley.
Hey, now let me tell you about a place out east, just 15 minutes from the LA streets. Hollywood doesn't even know we exist, like it's a mystical land filled with immigrants.
Here are some other video titles from the Fung Brothers: Thing Asian Parents Do, number 6, and I Can't Speak My Mother Tongue. Bill Radke talked with Andrew and David about growing up in Kent and how that informs their comedy.
This is David.
Yo, this is Andrew. It is an honor to be here right now.
Born and raised Kent East Hill. We in the building.
253 Deuce 5 Trey.
Unincorporated King County.
Key.
So I hear it. I hear it. Now, when you told people that you were from Kent, you were from the 253, from Kent, what kind of things would you hear?
Oh, the place with a lot of factories and warehouses. And I was like, what do you... Oh, yeah, I guess down the hill there are. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of my friends in business school, their parents owned companies where they would house their ships or something
their
in Kent.
Wood,
yeah.
Their wood.
Yeah,
their
some sort of. In Kent. But I was like, no, I'm housing my lifestyle and my family and our livelihood in Kent. They're like, oh, yeah, that's where I just keep whatever.
It was known for, being that place next to IKEA.
So King County is a lot more Asian now, but what was it like growing up Asian in Kent? And what would it be, the 90s?
Growing up in East Hill, you know, you still bumped into people who had like country rural accents, and you'd be like, I don't know how you have a rural accent. I don't know if you immigrated from Missouri or it's just like a mechanic blue collar. Like,
yep, I know that accent.
I still remember people be like, hey, how's it going?
Yep. And I think something that's funny, growing up in Kentwood, I don't think it's as common anymore, but we would see people wear cowboy boots and cowboy hats to school, like on hat day, that kind of area.
So it's not like my dad was working at Boeing. So of course my dad has to buy into like Fortune 500, you know, publicly traded company culture, which is, you know, white centric, which is like, hey, Jim, like, hey, well, how was the Snoqualmie this weekend? It really is like that.
And where were you in the, you know, people kind of, they tend to split up, right? They tend to group up. And where were you?
Well, pretty much in high school, at least this is David speaking, I pretty much associated myself with, the African-American community. You pick one or the other, at least in my grade, you pick white or black to hang out with because Asian was not really an option. A lot of the Asians, they opt to choose nothing and then nobody knows who they are. So that's why a lot of Asians at Kentwood, actually, they graduate 4 years and literally nobody has any idea who they are. But for me, I chose more, I guess, the African-American community to kind of hang out with.
I hear a kind of black American influence in your voices. Do you know what I'm talking about?
we listened to a lot of rap growing up.
I mean,
and
that was
that
kind
played
of
a lot of basketball.
Yeah, I played a lot of basketball, and that's who we learned to speak English.
This is the rap and basketball voice.
Yeah,
maybe David a little bit more than me. I think this is like goes to a larger idea of us like feeling relatable to a lot of Americans, and also why maybe we even got a chance at a TV show. It's because we're from a place like Kent, which is very American.
No, it's very Anytown USA.
Yeah, Anytown USA. I wouldn't say American in that way, but you know, it's very American. The demographics of our high school were pretty much like the demographics of America as of like maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, at that time.
At that time, it was pretty reflective.
And how did your parents were born in China. How did they end up in Kent?
Okay, long story short, our parents actually met in college at Ohio State, and they were part of the first wave of student immigrants allowed in by Nixon. And my dad took a job as an aerospace engineer at Boeing.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have different plants all over, but Kent is one of them. So my dad was like, hey, I don't, you know, want to go to commute too far. So yeah.
Kent was close by work, essentially. That's that's it.
But it's funny because, you know, most engineers, you know, our father has a PhD in computer science and he's like a very learned person. But, you know, most of them choose to live in Bellevue just because for the school district, the culture seems more fitting for a PhD.
Yeah.
But nah, we kept it real.
Can I ask you, now some people are just funny and they're entertainers. Did your Kent childhood shape your sense of humor?
Yes.
You could say that. I would say a couple of factors. I think our parents are actually, they're not like comedians, but they're kind of goofy.
Uh-huh.
And
it is interesting. And if you study the background of a lot of comedians, they do kind of come from like really generally like scholar like families, but are raised in kind of blue collar neighborhoods. Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., the list goes on and
That's
on.
Interesting.
Like a lot of, because you have to have an analytical perspective, but you have to see things. You know what I mean? Because like you meet kids sometimes from Bellevue at church, and they're growing up in a completely different Seattle than we are.
Uh-huh.
Their parents don't let them play basketball in the streets and go play AAU ball or play like just engage with any
go to parties in high school.
Basically, they don't let them be around other kids who are not academic centric.
Right. I want to talk about your YouTube channel focuses on Asianness, you know, immigrant parents, how non-Asians see you. Why do you focus there?
I think a lot of it is probably driven from growing up and a lot of people asking you being the only Asian that a lot of people know, or at least like stereotypical Asian. You know, when I say stereotypical Asian, most people are referring to like a Chinese or a Korean or a Japanese
person. Or maybe one of the only Asians that they're engaging with, that they feel comfortable talking to. Like, I know there was always some funny conversations. Like, oh, do you really know how to use chopsticks? Mm-hmm. They would like touch the middle of our forehead, like around like where our eyebrows are, and be like, oh, I never did this to an Asian before. Like, it's kind of like goofy
Why stuff do you guys' faces look so plain? Why don't you have eyelids?
Why are your eyes like this? And
but you know the funny thing is, it was literally because of lack of contact. These are not people whose like parents know any Asians.
Yeah, and they're not. I wouldn't necessarily say these kids are racist. Really, like they're just being kids. Like, you look different. What are you? What's going on here? Tell me about it.
And you know that some people's reaction is to just be like, that is such a small part of me, you know, and you want to see people on TV, Asians who are just people, and it's not all about their Asianness. You know, and that in your YouTube channel, you're really kind of diving into that, those perceptions, those questions.
Yeah. In my opinion, I actually, for the most part, disagree with that.
Okay.
You know, the thing about being Asian is nobody has the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a group of Asians who's like, you know, we're just like everybody else. Treat me like somebody else. Mm. But, you know, when you're more from like lower class, or like you've been around that a lot, and me and Andrew spent a lot of time around some really high class Asians and some really low class Asians, we are really different. We come from a completely different part of the world that was informed for thousands of years by different philosophers, different religions. We have nothing to do with the holy war type things that are going on. Like, we have absolutely no contact. We're not mentioned in the Bible. We're not a part of anything. And just because the Western narrative has dominated the globe for the past 300 to 500 years, I don't like it when Asians try to fit ourselves in there. Oh, yeah, like maybe Kings for the East in the Bible was referring to Mongoloid people. I'm like, come on, man. We were doing our own thing. We have our own culture. We have our own civilization that we were handling with Confucius and all these different people in Asia. Just because we're living in a Western context now that is globally dominant, we don't have to like try to find our place in something that we don't have a history in. Asians are not responsible for any of that.
But I think for us talking about Asians on our channel, it was largely because we wanted to analyze Asians, and we felt like Asians needed to have more discussions about ourselves. We were like, we got to have these conversations and make these jokes and break ourselves down like this before we move on. That's our opinion. I mean, I think, you know, you always have other people working on the other side, but I'm just like, yo, we got to talk about it first.
What are some of your favorite things to get at, to talk about, joke about, put a light on?
All right, basically when immigrants arrive to this country, and this is, I'm talking about America, there's this American pop cultural spectrum that ranges from white to black. And obviously you see it right now. There's flaring up between these two sides in America right now because, you know, there's a lot of anger throughout history between these two groups. Now, Asians, we come in here, Latinos too, where we arrive to a battle that's already happening. And then people go, hey, which side are you rolling with in this thing? And you're kind of like, what? I just wanted to come here and build a nice life for myself. I came from an internal civil war back in my home country. And now you want me to pick a social side that's blue or red or left or right? I think to me that is like, that's actually hilarious.
And then what, you want us to like be educated all about these social issues and understand all this stuff? I'm like, to be honest, a lot of the Asian immigrant parents, they didn't even go to college, or some of them didn't go to high school even where they're from. So how can they jump into this conversation? I'm like, give us a break, guys. Like, you got to give us like another generation before you like, well, Lee, you just got here. Whose team are you on? I don't know. The people who make my life better, who pay me. If it's white people, I'm voting. Like, you know, I don't know. Black people support me. Cool. Like, when you look at Obama, we're like, oh, Obama, he grew up in Asia partially. All right, cool. We vote for him if we are voting.
And then some of them go, oh, yeah, Trump's rich. I want to be rich. Now I vote for Trump.
You know exactly. What I mean?
Like, it's just like, it's really goofy that I think, in my opinion, and me and Andrew, essentially that's the crux thing that me and Andrew joke about, that we are this really different people that's been thrown into a Western cultural spectrum that has existed for hundreds of years, and you could even argue has existed for thousands of years, right? Europe and Africa being right next to each other, a boat ride away, right? Yeah. There's like 10 mountain ranges that are really huge that separate the Western world from the Far East. We're not just from the East, we're like from the far, far East. And I think it's funny that we have to find our place in that cultural context. And you essentially, we have no choice, but we try to.
You know, guys, I'm happy to be talking about politics and culture wars and global relations. It's funny to me because I know the Fung Bros mostly from, like, Asians Eat Weird Things and, you know what I mean? And your music video. And those
have depth.
Yes.
What we're talking about is actually, those are kind of like symptoms of what we're talking about.
Right.
A lot of that stuff was to describe why we're so different. Because I think that both sides, if you want to look at it like white and black are the only two people with cultural narrative power in America, which, you know, you could say that that's true, that I think both sides are like confounded by Asians.
I don't get it.
But to me, the whole fallacy is that we have to fit on that scale in the first place. And I think that that's what drives the content. So I guess, you know, we could talk about the content, but I guess to get meta and deep, because, you know, we are on KUOW.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of
for some educated people,
there's a lot of smart people,
some brainy
listening
folks. We'll just take it meta. You know, what are the systemic things that drive our comedy? And I think that one day me and Andrew are gonna delve into it on like a more on the nose, like meta level, which is more like a Hari Kondabula.
Yep.
You know, that style. But for that time in the era 6 years ago, me and Andrew were more trying to like dance around it and allude to it through being playful.
We threw it in there, definitely, but I think a lot of our earlier content was about like, listen guys, like, first of all, we just got to understand ourselves and be proud first, and then like, now obviously even doing this interview, we wouldn't be saying these same things like 4 or 5 years ago, and all we are saying is like, there's a bunch of factors.
We
think
can just
about
talk
them
about it.
Let's talk
about some difficult stuff that people don't want to talk about.
Yeah.
That's what we do. Fung Brothers, Andrew and David, thanks a lot for this.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate that.
We're tweeting out a link to the Fung Brothers YouTube channel right now. And I do recommend watching their full Get Out parody. It's pretty good. C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox. You've been with us this whole hour. Thank you for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
Bill Radke is back tomorrow. I'm Jeannie Yandel. And coming up next, we've got BBC News.